So my name is Edward Horton. I'm a partner at Stewart & Kissel. This panel is titled Value Dislocation in Shipping Stocks. I'm going to just do quick introductions, although I think most of the panelists are probably known to most of the people in the room. On my left is Jim Cerenza at DNB, Richard Diamond at Castlewood Capital Partners, Omar Nakta at Jefferies, Hamish Norton at Star, and Robert Bugby at Scorpio Tankers. When we were discussing this panel before this conference, one of the panelists said to me, he said, you're a perfect moderator for this topic because you don't have any preconceived notions of the issue. And I'm still trying to decide if that was a compliment or not. But I think it's the right point, because I think when we talk about valuation, one of the key issues is, what do we mean by value? There's a preconception, I think, that we talk about NAV and discount to NAV, but I think it's more complicated than that. So I think I'd like to just start, maybe Robert, I'll start at your end and just ask you the question is, how do you look at value in shipping stocks?
Oof. I didn't expect to go first. I've actually prepared for some of the easier philosophical questions of the day, like the meaning of life, the nature of reality, the existence of God, knowledge and truth, and free will versus determinism. But we have valuation, right? And as far as I'm concerned, it's a moving target that it changes around as to, it's a very emotional view. That the most common use, obviously, is net asset value in the industry, which that serves us well when it's convenient and is hopeless when we don't think it serves us well. So much of, you know, we don't really have we have such volatility in our industry that value is, can really fool people. You know, what history tells you is that the time when there's most premium to valuation, that's normally just before a real crash in the industry. At the time when there's the least premium or the most discount, normally preludes some form of recovery in the stocks that are around us. That's sort of just as a start.
Well, yeah, I guess we make a point, frankly, of not discussing net asset value with shareholders, because net asset value fundamentally is the liquidation value of the hard assets of the company. And, you know, unless management is subtracting value, and management does sometimes subtract value, I hope our management doesn't subtract value. The company should be worth substantially greater than the liquidation value of the hard assets. But, you know, I think there are two reasons why shipping companies often, or maybe now most of the time, trade below net asset value. And one is that a ship implicitly comes with a political risk insurance policy. If you buy a ship, it's worth the present value of future cash flows, but a widget company would be worth the present value of future cash flows. But if the political situation changes for the worse at your widget company's location, you have nothing you can do. You lose the widget company. If you have a ship, you can move it. And so a private transaction in a ship involves a greater value because you get the political risk insurance policy for free. A U.S. public shareholder is not looking for political risk insurance, doesn't think about political risk insurance, and isn't willing to pay for it. I'm not sure that anything can be done about that, in the sense that private market values do include, I think, the value of this political risk insurance policy that's implied. And the second problem is that, you know, not all shipping company managements have been good stewards of capital. And, you know, I think the industry is small enough that shareholders have a hard time figuring out who is a good steward of capital and who is not. And, you know, I think we're all tarred by that brush, unfortunately.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I guess I agree with Hamish and Robert. It's definitely it's a question that keeps, you know, has come up all the time is, well, why are shipping stocks cheap? But then we try to define, well, what is cheap and what are we looking at to define, you know, cheapness? And so NAV is always the one we fall back on because it's the easiest, as Robert said. You have valuations out there that we can all figure out what a company's worth. But I think at the end of the day is, Wall Street does not give credit to NAV, and it doesn't give credit to ship values. It gives credit to cash flow, and that's what matters. And so how much what's your NAV, but how much of that NAV are you turning into free cash flow each year? That's honestly what we've seen is going to justify whether you get a premium multiple or a discount. Is that NAV turning into free cash or not?
I have a slightly different view of things. I view NAV as an arrow in the quiver that contributes to making a decision, and as an investor can provide a margin of safety, because shipping ultimately is a cyclical stock, and when the stocks are the most expensive, i.e. earnings are low or earnings are non-existent, that's the best time to buy them. And when shipping stocks are cheap relative to EV to EBITDA or earnings, that's the best time to sell them because it usually means the market is pricing in a peak.
And I'll just wrap it up. I'm going to sound more like a ship owner than a investment banker, but I'm not a fan of NAV. I'm not sure we can always measure NAV. I'm a big fan of enterprise value divided by EBITDA, regardless of what sector you're looking at. I don't care which of the 11 sectors in the S&P you're looking at. So for those of you who enterprise value is just the value of your equity and the value of your debt, and don't underestimate the importance of the value of your debt. So back in 2020 and 2021, we had the two greatest years of debt issuance in the history of the world. And so here we are 5 years later, and the debt capital markets are on fire, but companies are refinancing at much higher rates than what they were looking at 5 years ago. To me, it's the totality of that capital structure divided by earnings, which is the common denominator. And as Richard said, that dictates when things are expensive and when things are cheap. And just having the asset, as Robert and Hamish pointed out, doesn't mean that management's given the same asset give you the same profit. To me, that profit is the driver.
But Omar, maybe I'll direct this to you, because, I mean, as an analyst, this is your goal to do that. So I'm trying to just drill down a little bit on this point. So when you look at a company, the topic that we're discussing today is dislocation, value dislocation. So if you're looking at a stock that's undervalued or overvalued or at fair value, I guess, is fair market value sort of the default measure that you would look at? Or is there something more to it than that in terms of like a recommendation or a price?
Yeah, it's a good question. One that we grapple with is, okay, NAV, just falling back to that, you know, a Capesize in today's market, a new building, is $75 million. 4 years ago, right before the eruption, it was $50 million. Why is it cost 75 versus 50? The price of steel is at best flat, if not lower. Labor is maybe a bit higher. But generally speaking, you shouldn't have a $75 million Cape if that's where it was 4 years ago, and you have the same construction cost. So what's driving that increase? Is it shipyard capacity? Is it that there's just no space available, and you have to pay 75? So then the shipping markets are having to transact at 75, but the earnings power is not there. Right? Like I think when we look back at 30 years of data and figure out what does a Capesize need to earn to justify this type of investment at 75, I mean, it's 34,000 a day, and the market hasn't averaged that. Even in 21, we barely got to that figure. So Wall Street is not giving credit to 75 million. Wall Street's giving credit to 50. And that's what we've been trying to do more work on, is saying, okay, well, we have net asset value, which is the industry standard for figuring out what a company's worth, but what is replacement value? Replacement value, theoretically, is based off of the price of a construction of a ship, which is at 75. But is the market truly 75 million? Does it really cost 75 million to build that ship? Or if there is enough capacity available, can you get it down to 50? And so I think that's ultimately where the market's pricing in, is what it costs to build a ship appropriately when you have capacity at the yards. Rightly or wrongly, but that seems to be what the market's looking at.
And Richard, is that where you
make the decision to buy? It's a market, and there's always a buyer and seller, and everyone thinks about it differently. 2 weeks ago, I started buying Starbulk stock because, I think Hamish is a great steward of capital, and along with his team. B, they're the smartest guys in the room, along with companies like G&K and some of the other firms that are here. 3, I'm looking for asymmetry, which means I want risk of 10% down. And what happens in a normal recovery? Well, in a normal recovery, I think Starbulk should trade between $23 to $25 a share. So if I'm buying it below 16, I have roughly 50% of upside. And then, what's my margin of risk? Well, if I'm buying an asset for 60 cents on the dollar, that provides me with a lot of comfort. So, everybody thinks about it differently. A lot of it comes down to what your holding period is, whether you're going to hold something for a day, 30 days, or indefinitely. If I buy something cheap enough, I'm an indefinite holder. And it's a signal. And Hamish did not pay me to say that.
But I think that I agree totally with what Richard is saying in relation to him. But you've got certain markets out there where there's, frankly, it's like, I don't know why people keep writing, this tanker company or this product tanker company is 60% of NAV or 55 or 70 or whatever like that. And they make no mention of the cash flows of any of these companies at all. And what we've seen historically in markets that are getting weaker or anticipated to getting weaker is the companies, 2008, 2009 was classic. And I didn't have an axe to grind because the company we had, we'd sold. You would see analysts just follow OSG down. And OSG followed it all the way into Chapter 11, all the way saying that they were trading well below NAV. And never did they actually address the cash flow aspect that Jim is talking about. Now, here I'm talking about a negative position, but it just goes to show that at the end of the day, a shipping company actually functions on its cash and its cash flow. So NAV pricing from equity analysts have been very slow to adjust in both up and down in some of the markets. It took a long time after COVID for them to march the NAVs up, despite the fact that some of the values in the product market were going up 20% in a period of a month or two. And I think that's something that is there. And then in other senses, and this is for you, is that, let's say, one of my biggest bugbear for the industry is these desire all the time for full payout dividend companies that do function well when everything's going well, and historically they've tended to go into Chapter 11 when things don't, with the exception of one company over time, which has performed, if you want to talk about valuation, has performed better than any other shipping company for many years, and that is Nordic America Tankers. So I'm sitting next to the person who is the cause of some of my biggest issues at the moment, because it was Hamish who actually created the structure for Nordic America Tankers at the beginning. And we'll come to that later in capitalization of companies, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I agree that NAV is not what you should be looking at. You should be looking at cash flow, and yet, you know, I see NAV used for companies with operating costs that vary by as much as $2,000 a day, mm-hmm. and, you know, chartering results that vary by more than that, in a consistent way. And, you know, you can have two companies who consistently differ in expenses by $2,000 a day, you know, operating costs and overhead and chartering by more than that, and still they're compared on NAV.
I agree, which is also Jim's point.
Yeah.
That's the cash flow part of it.
Right. But it doesn't seem to...
change.
It doesn't seem to change, right.
So maybe, Robert, you introduced that topic. So coming back to what companies, I guess, can... or let's start with what they can do. So, I mean, dividends, stock repurchases, all of the sort of the usual aspects for companies to at least increase the stock price, maybe not the valuations. One is, I guess, do they work over the long term from a valuation perspective? Hamish, maybe I'll start with you because you've...
Sure. Look, I think if one's share is trading well below liquidation value and you have cash and you want to spend the cash, probably the best thing you can do with the cash is to buy back shares. I'm not sure that that affects the ratio of share price to liquidation value, but it increases the liquidation value per share. And so it's a good thing for your shareholders, but I'm not sure it changes the basis of valuation at all in the public markets.
I mean, I think basically it just comes down to, are you a good steward of capital, as we were talking about at the beginning? That's ultimately what we think drives valuation. And Robert alluded to that earlier. When you have a high payout structure that works in an exciting way in an up market, but then in a back market, you know, belly up is a real risk, and the valuation matches that. So we don't think buying back stock, paying dividends in the long run actually leads to a premium valuation. We haven't seen it.
A premium valuation in the sense of a better ratio of market value to NAV.
Yes.
Yeah.
It works in every other sector. So the day will come where it will work in this sector as well. I know that the shipping industry has been around for a little while, but the day will come. So from an investor's point of view, dividend yield on the S&P right now is actually less than 1.3%. We are really, really close to an all-time low on dividend yield. So it doesn't take a lot of dividend to be better than the average stock in the U.S. You know, in the meantime, the U.S. S&P companies pay out about $600 billion a year in dividends, and we announce way more than twice of that in share buybacks, although we don't execute all of that that's announced. But I think the pendulum in general has gone too far in terms of share buybacks versus dividends. But getting back to share buybacks again, I believe it works in two scenarios. It works when your share buyback is absolutely enormous, like Apple Computer, and you can buy back $110 billion worth of stock in a year. And I think it works when your stock is trading at a big, big discount to what you view as being reasonable value.
Well, I think a lot of it depends on the clientele of the investors owning the stock. If you have growthy investors, they're thinking about spending to grow the business. If you have value investors, they're looking at free cash flow yields. If you have retail investors, they may be looking to dividends. I've been looking at my MLPs, and I can tell you that the ones that are consistent and have strong retail participation have less volatility than those that have more varied results, but more institutional ownership, where the time horizons are shorter. I like stock buybacks. I like dividends. I like getting paid to wait. I like it when the, you know, I'm among the last shares standing. But, you know, it all has to be done judiciously. And different companies have different holders who want different things.
I think it also depends on the time you are in the cycle. I mean, in the 2000s, between 2005 and 2007, the company, as we then, bought back 37.5% of its share flow and then promptly sold the company. But we were in a cycle where, rightly or wrongly, there was very high growth through the world. There was a lot of liquidity, a lot of interest, and there was much more certain economic outlook at that point, with all cylinders firing throughout the world there. And I think that buying back stock is, Wall Street's never satisfied, right? So look what happened to the companies that started to buy some stock in December and January, but didn't re-up their buybacks in February, right? It's Wall Street just says, thank you for what you gave me. Sometimes they don't even say that. They really say, what are you going to do for me next? And so you've got to be prepared in a buyback to, if you're doing it, to keep going and keep going and keep going. And danger there in a market that you have at the moment, where it's reasonable to think, look at the broad markets, look at what Warren Buffett's doing, is the broad markets are saying there's potential of unusual risk to the downside. And our industry doesn't react to the downside in gentle moves. It's very, very vicious. The other part of it is that, you know, we got to look at ourselves as an industry. This is only part of what we're talking about. The most horrific thing that I've seen recently is that the three largest, you know, bulk non-container companies, bulk or tankers, in the public markets are smaller in market cap than the three largest companies in 1988. Okay, we have had the boom during the end of the 80s. We have had the mega boom in all the way through the 2000s. We've had extraordinary positive cash flows in these last years. And yet our market caps in the industry are lower, are dreadful. And I fundamentally believe that valuation, part of real sustainable valuation, and acting like proper companies, as Jim looks at every day, and long onlys want to be involved with, and lenders too, is going to be getting market cap. And the way that we act as an industry of, let's get the money, give it back to the shareholders for tax reasons or their retail, is just never going to cut it.
Yeah, I mean, of course, one of the big problems building a company with a market cap that's sensible in today's market, which I think is minimum $5 billion.
Yeah.
Is that if your share is trading below net liquidation value of
hard
assets, you can't buy anything.
Right.
Right. And it's very difficult to do mergers. And you know, if the shares are trading that badly, your merger partners aren't very big anyway.
And you can have a company trading under NAV for months or years. And the moment you put in a cash offer, all the shareholders suddenly, you know, they would have gladly sold the company for 20% more the day before, but now they want a premium to net asset value because that's what sellers get.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this goes on in, you know.
Yeah.
This hasn't been, it's very, very hard. When the New York shareholder base, the moment an offer is put on the table, they immediately think their company is worth the premium.
Well, I mean, it probably was.
Oh, of course, of course. I'm sure you would agree. You know, your ships are the best dry kits in the world.
Well, it's not just the ships, right? It's
everything. The full package.
Yeah, the ships aren't worth anything without people to run them.
I understand that, but I'm talking about the shareholder. The shareholder themselves can.
Yeah, well, the shareholder was, as you say, prepared to sell for 20% below NAV. Prior. But no, look, I mean, basically what the pricing of shipping shares is telling us is that the investors would like the companies to liquidate.
Huh. Well, that, to me, what the shares are telling us at this point now is that the investors are either beaten up badly because they made so many losses in the last few months, that they're having less money to manage because their LPs or their private people are giving more money to index funds, or they're just scared witless right now of making longer term investments, and they can't afford to invest in small cap shipping companies that once they bought it could be down 10% the next day on a tweet from one of the governments in the world. That's what it tells me. Is lack of certainty.
Yeah, and we're pushing the needle a little bit in terms of free float. So what's the market cap? Well, we're pushing it a little bit in average daily volume relative to where we were last May, June. And so it's not as easy for a mutual fund to buy a shipping name as it was in the first or second quarter of last year.
Other than you'll have to stop trading in some of the shipping
companies.
You've
got a couple of very large shipping companies at this end of the table, but we don't have large shipping companies everywhere.
I think this is the opportunity. And, sometimes I feel like the proverbial kid and the candy store. I mean, you don't need to be a genius to make money investing in shipping stocks. You have to be 10 to 15% smart and 85 to 90% not stupid. And you could come to conferences like Capital Link, Marine Money. You have the conference Geneva Dry, Monaco Splash, and you can meet with the leading lights of the industry. You can. You don't need to have a PhD in comp sci to understand what's going on. And with Twitter, you get shipping data that used to be very expensive on a daily basis. And so I think there are more opportunities today than ever. But the problem is, who's running Wall Street firms today? People who made their way up in tech. And value has been out of fashion for at least the last decade, and there are fewer and fewer practitioners. You have the growth of the pod shops. They're lever 5-to-1. They invest on earnings or shorter catalysts. And last but not least, you have the algos, buying and selling packages. And they may, see a headline on China and say, okay, let's short a package of stocks on China. We'll short everything on shipping. And if you've got patience, this less efficient market creates enormous opportunity. And, when people sell stocks at stupid prices, I get to buy them. And when people buy stocks at stupid prices, I get to sell them. Investing is not fair. Stocks are not fair, have feelings. So, I understand Robert's frustration, Hamish's.
I'm frustrated for the industry. I think that to me, I'm real simple. The market's the market. The price is the price. That's it. I've never complained once about the price of a stock I own or a stock I'm involved with.
I mean, you could read a great analyst like Omar, who has really insightful things. You could even reach out to him and ask him questions. It's not like it's a secret and it's buried. I mean, you've got all these tools in front of you, and, you know, we should be grateful that other investors can be such idiots, because that's opportunity for us.
Omar, maybe I'll switch the topics a little bit. So you talked about stewards of capital and that the concept of stewards of capital. How some of your peers are much more focused on corporate governance issues. How much of an impact does that have on pricing for companies that maybe critique that? And does that affect pricing for across the sector for public companies, or is it just limited to the companies that sort of get mentioned in terms of not being as good stewards as others?
Yeah, no, so corporate governance just as a theme.
I mean, structural issues. And
yeah, I mean, it's something that has plagued the industry for as long as I've covered it, is the different corporate governance issues and the games that can be played with related entities that are, getting fees from the public company. And while the vast majority of the time those fees are consistent with fees you would pay to an independent, non-related party, it still just creates a level of uncertainty and trust or mistrust. So I would say that it is something that, big picture, has affected the industry, because I do talk to many investors who, you know, typical, you know, long onlys or plain vanilla, who say, listen, I know this industry can be kind of, you know, whatever you call it, with that type of stuff. But it's an overhang. But it's probably more an issue in the downtimes, in all honesty. It's always when things aren't going well, when earnings are declining, or something bad's happening in the macro, you tend to point fingers and try to figure, okay, what's the reason for that? And you just point to these things. But in the upmarket, no one really focuses on it.
Governance is very important to me, because I have limited brain cells, and I don't want to spend time with management teams that I don't like or trust. So, for example, look at Golden Ocean. It carried a premium because it was a John Fredrickson company. It was purchased by the Savories, who have at best a very mixed track record. Actually, their track record is for capital destruction. And it now trades at a discount. And, again, it's holding. To me, the fact that I don't have to worry about Safe Bulkers or Genco or many of the other companies I own, that's something I look for, because I don't want to make my life worse. But, it's a market, and other people feel differently.
I thought that it's very hard to have got in the shipping industry more value in terms of entertainment than what was happening in Golden Ocean and Norway's reaction this last week or two.
Yeah.
That was value.
Well, I'm just glad that John Fredrickson got some cash, which he then invested in Star. And, he obviously knows all the tricks, and he must think that these tricks are not happening at Star, which is, I think, an endorsement I'll try to use with investors.
I think it's a great endorsement.
Well, look, when you guys had your position in DHT, I own DHT. They get a premium valuation because they're consistent. They do a very good job in their space. And I don't remember Sami, but when you bought 7%, I thought, gee, that's really smart.
Yeah. I'm getting a commonality here. The things that you like, things that help you, which is great.
Absolutely.
That falls into that 85% not stupid, right?
Correct.
Yeah, but yeah.
Can I interject with a question? Because we don't talk about
Well, I think, I was going to say, and we talked about this a little bit on the analyst panel, Chris, we were sitting next to each other 6 months ago here at the Fall Capital Link. I think the fundamental issue is probably we need a change in the growth outlook, because when we look at conventional shipping, that's containers, tankers, and dry cargo, you can't make a compelling growth case in either of those three sectors. Can you make it in containers? Especially not now with tariffs. Dry bulk, old industry, China's slowing, which has been the main engine. And, of course, oil, you're grappling with peak oil at some point. And so there's no real sexy growth story, which had been driving the market 20 years ago. And that's what brought the premium valuations. Now we're in this sector where there's no growth. We just have to grapple with it being a value sector for some time until the growth story changes. Well, it's different in other transportation. I don't cover the actual transports, but in trucking, there's no true sort of net asset value. Then you kind of fall back on, okay, EV, EBITDA, what are operating margins looking like? So you focus a little bit more on maybe bigger picture adult-style valuation versus NAV, which is what we always fall back on. We have the benefit or the luxury of falling back on Clarksons and Fernleys and whomever else putting out valuations that make our lives easier and figuring out, okay, what is the starting point? Blank slate, what's this company worth without me doing any other work?
I think it helps if we start to get bigger companies. I think it helps if we start to deleverage the industry. And I think that you'll get those more stable investors. I mean, I'll share with somebody, I won't give the source, but it's super conservative, long only, big, and, you know, has invested in shipping, you know, through every single cycle, certainly since the 80s. And that the head of that, the whole fund group said to me about 14 months ago, in a peak of frustration, he said, when he saw that what was happening was that companies were paying out dividends, buying back stock when they still had a lot of leverage, he said, when is just one of you in your industry going to act like a normal company that we invest in every day? And what he meant by that was that other big companies in the world, cyclical companies or whatever, we're not talking the apples here, which grow like crazy, but he was saying, none of you have historically retained money during an up cycle. You've spent it on ordering new ships or paying dividends or buying back stock. And what you should be doing is taking down debt and, you know, not paying out so much in dividends so that you can really take advantage of the cyclicality itself. And I think that will perhaps provide the change in the industry later, because the other part that point I'd make is that as we've had successive markets, less and less has been raised by those companies. I mean, I don't think there's been a single real big dollar raised in the last, you know, 2 or 3 years that actually matters. And that's quite, you know, it should be quite a scary thought to an industry that has an aging fleet, a record aging fleet. So.
Well, I think, you know, what it should be scary to actually are the customers. For the industry, it's in some sense a good thing that the fleet is aging, because what that means is that the companies will all have many years of, or a few years anyway, of extreme profit, and then the customers won't have any carrying capacity.
In some industries, yeah, but in tankers, they don't really like oil and product on their coastlines and stuff, so...
Well, iron ore and coal sinks,
bottom,
it's not a big deal.
But,
yeah. quite seriously, it's the customers who are going to be in trouble, if the industry is unable to get investors to look at the companies as operating companies as opposed to collections of assets,
yeah,
that it will value at a discount. And, you know, I do think size is important. If you had a company with as many ships as a typical trucking company has trucks, you know, the people wouldn't consider the possibility of liquidation value because it would be just absurd.
Yeah,
that number of assets.
Yeah, but I think that we can complain about bankers like Jim. We can complain about shareholders like Rich. We complain about Homer all day long if we want to, but we can't really complain about our customers, can we?
Well, I'm not complaining about the customers. I'm simply saying that the risk is with the customers, actually, and not with the shipping companies. The risk of the investors not valuing the companies high enough is going to lead to a big problem with the
even blaming it on the investors. To me, it's the owners as a community are so caught up in this short-sightedness by the investors and the parameter that, you know, someone who's borrowing the stock for a couple of months on a quarterly trade or whatever, you know, I don't think, you know, you shouldn't be swayed by that view at all. You should be managing the company for the longer term. I mean, as you do.
Robert and Hamish, I think we are over our time, so I will stop there. But thank you. Thank you, everyone. This is the one panel we did not discuss about the Chinese fleets and other valuations on that. So.